Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Harry Markopoulos spent 9 years trying to alert the world to Bernie Madoff's $65 billion Ponzi scheme, a scheme he says it took him 5 minutes to recognize. He went to the SEC 5 times, starting in May 2000. He warned investors. He tried to give the story to the press. In a new book, he says he feared for his life, says he feared he might have to kill Bernie Madoff to survive. Then it all went public. Now Markopoulos is telling his story this hour on Point. Harry Markopoulos and the band of investment industry insiders who saw that Bernie Madoff was off the rails. You can join the conversation. Why wasn't anybody watching, probing, listening? Did you lose a bundle to Madoff? How does it feel to know we were warned? Do you trust that the government is looking out for you now? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. I should say we invited the SEC to join the conversation today, but the agency declined to put anyone on with Harry Markopoulos. Harry Markopoulos joins me now from New York. He spent most of a decade building a case against Bernie Madoff and trying to get regulators to take action. From 1991 to 2004, he worked as a securities executive at Rampart Investment Management. He now works privately as a forensic accounting analyst. He's co-author of No One Would Listen, a true financial thriller. Harry Markopoulos, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And with me in the studio, and we're very happy to have him, Frank Casey. He worked with Harry at Rampart Investment Management, helped uncover the Madoff scheme, now works at Close Asset Management, a wealth management bank based in London. He is also co-author of No One Would Listen. Frank Casey, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Harry, let's go straight to this. There's so much to talk about here. You've been talking, but I mean, the pages of this book are stuffed with absolutely fascinating detail, and I'm sure many others are eager to learn more. But the part that surprised me in all this was that you were actually afraid for your life. And I wish you'd explain why. And when you say you thought you might have to kill Bernie Madoff yourself, in what circumstances might that have looked necessary to you?
Well, the government wasn't doing their job. They weren't protecting me, my family, or investors. Madoff obviously wiped out thousands of families. One more wasn't going to make a difference to this monster. And in 2002, when I went to Europe, I saw the offshore nature of his feeder fund complex over there, and I knew that he was either criminally insane or an organized crime boss himself. I'm not sure which, even to this day, but he was stealing from the Russian mob and the Latin American drug cartels, and so I knew that he had a lot to fear if those people found out he was stealing from them, and so I began to fear for my life as well.
You were carrying a pistol. You were checking under the wheel, in the wheel wells of your car every time you got in. It was completely on your mind, not just for yourself, but for your family. Frank Casey, did you think Harry had lost his marbles when he was that worried, or you were in the thick of it too? Did it look logical, reasonable to you to have that worry?
Well, first of all, when you're dealing with an unknown, and Madoff was a big unknown, we didn't really that's always unnerving to try to judge where this man was coming from and what he was capable of. Harry was the only person out front. He was walking point. Mm-hmm. We were clandestine behind
the scenes. On point, we like to say.
Yeah, mm-hmm. On point. Mm-hmm. And we were clandestine operators basically digging up human intelligence for Harry to compile his work in submissions to the SEC. So we were not at risk, really.
But Harry was.
Harry was.
And Harry, it was your concern that if there was big offshore money in here, as you say, could be Russian mob or Colombian drug lords, these are guys who don't mess around if their investments are in trouble, certainly if they're imperiled by one guy.
And you could see that Madoff had weeks to he knew he was running short of cash. He had weeks to plan an escape if he wanted to escape. But he had stolen from the wrong people, from the wrong countries, and so there was no place to run or hide. And that's why he turned himself in. He never disputed the charges against him because he needed to seek the safety of a prison cell.
Otherwise, you might have the Russian mob on him. Were you serious that if your role emerged, if it became public, if you felt threatened, you were prepared to go after Bernie Madoff himself?
Yes, it was either me or him at that point, and I know how he was going to decide. I mean, this is a man that has no conscience. He has no compunction for human life. He's irrespective of human life. He was a total human predator, And I knew how he was going to decide, and I was going to make the decision for him. If I thought he knew, I was going to go down to New York and take him out.
We'll hear how your desire to both make this public but not be too public yourself because of that risk played out through all of this. It's really interesting. You call in the book the Madoff operation as obvious as a red wagon in a field of snow, and you say you spotted it in 5 minutes. How? Why, Harry?
Two main things. His performance chart, the line actually rose at a 45-degree angle, and that's clearly impossible because the markets go up and down. He was impervious to market conditions. He was always up. And the second factor was 96% of his months were up. That would be equivalent to a Major League Baseball player batting 960, given what we know about the ethical climate and tone at the top of Major League Baseball. You would suspect cheating immediately, and so we did.
I mean, you were in the business. You were looking at his numbers, or what he was presenting at his numbers, and there was just no way, no how?
Not unless he was an alien from outer space with perfect foreknowledge of the capital markets. You could not be human and achieve the returns that he was purporting to achieve. And I was managing similar type of products in the marketplace, and I knew what the math was capable and what wasn't capable in that strategy. And so clearly I knew it was a fraud right away. We just didn't know what type. I had two fraud theories. Fraud theory number one, he was front-running. In other words, the returns were real, but they were illegally generated. And fraud theory number two was, it was merely a Ponzi scheme. But we didn't have enough information in 2000 when we started the case to differentiate between the two, so we equally weighted them at 50-50.
So it turns out to be a Ponzi scheme. Front-running, well, that's when he's going to be investing a lot of money. He knows what's going in, and he makes his bets in advance to profit from them. That's not kosher either. Frank, you're in the business also. You were trying to compete with this Madoff operation, and talking with Harry about, hey, can we bring these returns in too? He's setting the bar here. Can we match them?
Absolutely. I started in the business in 1974, and I had the great fortune of actually getting into this strategy in 1975 called split strike conversion, the very strategy that Bernard Madoff said he was using to generate these returns.
You protect your upside and your downside with puts and calls. If it goes up or down, you're covered. You don't make a killing, but you can.
But it's still,
they say, make that steady return.
But as we say in the industry, is still path dependent. In other words,
right.
All I've done is given away some upside for downside protection,
right.
Insurance. However, the markets need to go up on the stocks that I've picked in order to make money.
Right.
And so we all believed that we couldn't generate that rate of return. Now, Harry, in his previous position with Rampart, had been doing some work that involved dynamic timing, which means making decisions along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to capture upwards of two-thirds of the return of the stock market with about one-third of the risk of the market.
That's pretty good.
Now, Bernie, of course, was getting 96% of that.
And potential customers. And here's where it gets interesting.
Yes.
People with
we
money, lots of money, they saw that, and they wanted the Madoff return.
The secret in those days was consistency of return, 1% a month. If you could come in with anything close to that, you could have more money, billions coming over your transom. And I was challenged when I was at Rampart working with Harry to try to develop some financial products that would produce something along those lines over 2 or 3 year rolling periods. It was structured financial deals wrapping hedge funds.
So please, Harry, help me do this because I need this to compete out there in the field. And Harry, you saw this yourself, Frank was telling you. In a way, Madoff, it may have been completely bogus, but he was setting the expectations of wealthy investors.
And not only that, he was taking money from all the legitimate asset managers in Boston and in other places around the globe as well, because it's impossible to compete against a Ponzi scheme. I know so many asset managers have told me they were losing clients to Madoff because they were down in 2000 to 2003 in that killer bear market that we had, and Bernie was up, up, and away, and so all the assets flowed over to Bernie, and we were being penalized for being legitimate players.
A red wagon in a field of snow stands out like crazy. When you took this to the SEC, and you did that again and again, what was their response?
Dumb looks. If dumb looks were dollar bills, I would have walked out of the room each time a wealthy man. In 2000, they trashed my submission upon receipt. In 2001, it actually got to New York. They trashed it there. 2005, the Boston regional office believed every word I said. They thought it was an important case. It was a matter of urgency. They forwarded it to New York at the highest levels. And New York just dropped the ball on day one. The investigation was never on course.
Here's Bernie Madoff himself in a meeting with a not-for-profit group, the Philoctetes Center, in 2007, talking about his ties to the SEC. Here's Bernie Madoff.
I'm very close with the regulator, so I'm not trying to say that they can't, you know, that what they do is bad. As a matter of fact, my niece just married one.
Yeah, I'm all tied up with them. Was that the problem, Harry, or the SEC just didn't know or didn't want to know what was going on?
They were tied up with him. He was a big firm. He was trading 5 to 10% of the daily stock exchange volume. The SEC doesn't do cases against the big firms. They basically enforce rules against the small-time players only. They're certainly captive to the industry. And he was literally in bed with the industry. He would actually show up at the SEC's advisory board committees. He would help train the SEC staff. He would offer them tours of his operation. He wanted to be as close to them as possible. He wanted to know his enemy. He wanted to know what they were capable of, and he wanted to know their weaknesses, and he played off those weaknesses like a master.
Here he is at that same meeting telling, I guess, potential investors that in today's regulatory environment, you couldn't get away with any hanky-panky.
You know, in today's regulatory environment, it's virtually impossible to violate rules. I mean, this is something that the public really doesn't understand. But it's impossible for you to go for a violation to go undetected. Certainly not for a considerable period of time.
Frank Casey, what a joke. He was going undetected with billions and billions and billions of Ponzi scheme.
Absolutely.
Wow, Bernie Madoff just saying it right there. And Harry, that's exactly what you were yelling about in SEC with zero response? I mean, it's just incredible.
And Bernie Madoff, you can see he's a pathological liar, and he tells lies to his own benefit, obviously. What he should have said was it's virtually impossible to get caught given the current staff at the SEC. They're securities lawyers. They don't know math or finance. Not one of them is capable of doing any of the math to catch me, and he knew that, and he was basically waving it in their face.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the man who was on to Bernie Madoff before it all went down with Harry Markopoulos and his band of investment industry insiders who saw that Bernie Madoff was off the rails before his Ponzi scheme exploded into public view. Harry Markopoulos is with us. Frank Casey is with us, authors, co-authors of No One Would Listen, a true financial thriller. Of course, it all came out in December 08 and kept coming out for a long time, worse and worse, deeper and deeper. In February last year, Harry testified before Congress about the problems with the SEC and the Madoff scandal. Near the end of that, here's New York Congressman Gary Ackerman addressing the SEC after hearing the testimony of Harry Markopoulos.
One guy with a few friends and helpers discovered this thing nearly a decade ago, led you to this pile of dung that is Bernie Madoff, and stuck your nose in it, and you couldn't figure it out. You couldn't find your backside with two hands if the lights were on. Could you explain yourselves? You have single-handedly diffused the American public of any sense of confidence in our financial markets if you are the watchdogs. You have totally and thoroughly failed in your mission. Don't you get it?
Congressman Gary Ackerman at hearings where Harry Markopoulos was testifying. Let's get a call from Naples, Florida. Dave, you're on the air.
Yeah. How you doing? I'm just wondering if the charts were showing that they were going up at a 45% straight up 45% rate, how did so many smart, intelligent individuals miss it? I mean, the economy was obviously built on construction because everything else was bad. And you're talking the SEC, all the investors.
So how could they miss it? We've got it, Dave, a 45-degree angle, I think our guests were saying. But that was a lot of consistent high returns year after year after year. Harry, how could so many smart people see those returns and buy it?
Well, some 2 years the markets was going up 30 and 40%. Madoff would go up an average of about 12% net to his investors. And they missed it because if you looked at his statements, it showed 30 to 50 blue chip stocks that you'd be proud to own. They were well diversified. He had a protective put option underneath to protect you from market crash risk. So you looked at it, it looked like a perfectly safe vehicle. So you'd invest 100% of your assets into it willingly. You'd violate the first rule of any investor, which is diversify. You didn't think you need to because the portfolio looked diversified. The only risk that was well hidden was manager fraud risk. That's what they never saw, and that's what came to bite them.
Frank, you are out there talking with people with money, though, to try and get that money into your fund and into your business. I mean, did you ever cock your eyebrow at them and say, look at this chart. Does this make sense to you when it comes to Madoff? Could you say that?
Absolutely. Every time I met anyone in the business that was a risk manager at an international bank or a very savvy investor, the conversation would always come to something along these lines. Frank, what you're explaining to me sounds very good, but, you know, Bernie Madoff has this 12% a year. He never loses. I mean, he has only lost 3 months in the last 10 years or whatever, you know. He's batting a
960. Could you say to them, my friend, you know that's got to be BS somehow?
Absolutely. And it would be wink, wink, nod, nod. He's probably not generating this from market-driven rates of return. That's the code word for saying these things aren't coming from
this
the marketplace.
Is fiction, somehow.
This is fiction. And it's probably because of his inside knowledge of his broker-dealer arm, which meant front-running in a way. But he's our crook, is what they would insinuate. And the SEC has a role of defending the public against crooks. So if the SEC hasn't found out anything, then chances are it's something that's so slick inside of Madoff's operation in front-running his clients' order flows, that he's passing these returns to us for our benefit because we're real close friends.
Harry, he's our crook. That's where this really got interesting to me in reading the book. I mean, you saw this especially clearly, it seemed to me, in Europe. You went, you talked to the folks there. Madoff was sopping up a lot of money from Europe, from very, high-placed people in society there. And you came away with the impression that they understood very well that this couldn't be on the straight and narrow, but as long as it lined their pockets, somebody else got hurt, they didn't care, these rich investors.
That was the Europeans' code of ethics. To them, insider trading is okay. It's only a problem for those silly Americans. And so they were fine with keeping those returns for themselves. They are assuming that if Madoff was caught, he'd go to prison for a long, long time, but they'd be able to keep their ill-gotten returns because they'd be beyond the reach of the U.S. court system.
But, I mean, did you find that same? This is the point at which my sympathy for the victims, and I know people got hurt very badly, but still, did you find that more widespread? Did you find that among American investors? I mean, was this a kind of, were the investors in a way in on it? Because it was obvious to a smart investor this couldn't work, so, but it would be somebody else's problem, not theirs.
No, I'd say the Europeans were in on it. The best thing you could say about the European investors is they came from offshore feeder funds. And they were tax cheats. They weren't declaring the income in their host nation. That's why they remain silent to this day. In the U.S., they really were victims. People actually did believe. They were lied to. They were deceived. They were told by these feeder fund managers that there was due diligence being conducted, that they had done exhaustive checks. They were verifying the assets and the performance, when in fact these feeder fund operators were taking so much money from Madoff that they were looking the other way and lying to these investors, and they wiped them out.
But, Frank, he had to keep bringing in more and more and more. It was
Absolutely.
A Ponzi scheme. It had to be a big inflow all the time.
Let me tell you how big this monster is, the feed. If you're paying the end client investor 12% or 1% a month, and then you're paying the intermediary feeder fund who's bringing the poor investor to
the suckers
the monster,
to the table, and they made a lot of money doing
that. And you're paying them what the manager would normally charge in a hedge fund of 1% and 20% of the profits. So you're really talking about another 4% on top. So that's 16% all in. To feed that monster, just to keep it standing still, you have to raise the amount that you already have invested every 4.25 years. So in other words, if you're running a $5 billion fraud, you have to raise another $5 billion over 4.25 years just to stand still because that money has gone out the door.
Huge.
To make any money, you have to raise more than that. And so it was a monster that you cannot feed forever. We were looking for cracks
in the structure.
The
world runs out of money. The big-time investors just aren't enough of them
at some point. That is one of the most common cases in all Ponzi schemes, is that they run out. You'd have to insure everybody in the world if you're an insurance company. You'd have to buy every stamp 20 times over, 1,000 times over if you're Ponzi.
Harry, and yet it was an invitation-only kind of an operation. You had to be almost invited to put your money with Bernie Madoff.
He made a big show of turning away investors. He would take one investor, then turn away the investor's brother. He would also hunt at funerals, weddings, and bar mitzvahs. He was a true human predator. It was like dating. You always liked the girl that turns you down. And that's the way it was with Bernie. He was a master of psychology.
We didn't know anything about the individual investors. You see, Harry, myself, Neil Cello, mm-hmm. Mike Okrant, we were institutional.
All co-authors of the book, yep. No One Would Listen.
We were part of all the, we were the team members, and we were institutionally trained. So we were looking for the big banks, the intermediary feeder funds and the like, mm-hmm. and tracking them. We never thought about the individual investor because why would he need to go there? He was always closed, but then you would hear another feeder fund that would pop up in Vancouver or
Columbia
mm-hmm. or coming out of Switzerland someplace. So the money was always coming in over the transom. So we understood the game of exclusivity, mm-hmm. and we understood that was his marketing concept, mm-hmm. And he could always draw enough money in from the institution. Why would he need to go to individual investors? Why raid the synagogues? Mm-hmm. We didn't understand that until 30 days before Bernie blew up. Of course, we didn't know he was going to blow that particular time.
But he had to do it because?
Well, he had to do it because, well, I personally believe he did it with the individual investors, not so much for the money but for the ego.
Huh. He wanted them to beg him to let them
I mean,
their millions
he could have
him.
Raised another billion here, another billion there from the institutions.
Maybe they would have been
days.
On to him more quickly, though.
No. Because there was always somebody in the middle that was willing to make money feeding victims into the monster.
I mean, that's the other thing. The feeders, I mean, and who knows how any individual one acted or what their motivations were, but they made money. They didn't have a motivation, Harry, to expose something if it was going wrong here. They were making a ton of money.
It was the golden goose. They never wanted to ask questions. They were getting paid a lot of money not to ask those questions. If you ask too many questions, Bernie would yell at you and say, well, then I don't want you in my fund. I'm not going to take any more of your client money. I'm closed to you. And that's how he did it. He was a master at playing to people's greed.
Let's go to Christian in Boston. Christian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a comment and a question. My comment was the financial system, I believe, was founded in a moral society, and I don't see any kind of, like, moral thought going into, like, most of investors. Like, you can't get something for nothing, but everybody just wanted to get 12%
yep.
for nothing, I guess. They just wanted to put their money somewhere and see it grow.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in two affluent societies here in America where a lot of kids ended up becoming hedge fund managers because their parents had a ton of money and didn't know what to do with them. And these kids were, like, I mean, they were not smart kids, not, like, nice kids growing up, but their parents gave them a bunch of money and told them to go have fun and make more out of it.
Yeah.
And when I say a bunch of money, I mean we're talking multimillionaires, not just like a couple thousand here.
Yeah.
And I guess my question was, once you're at the top, like, nobody wants to leave the top. Once you have all that money, I mean, whether you've got it through honest means or unhonest means, the people who have it there were too scared to lose their money. So, I mean, they all just kept going with Bernie. But, I mean, does that mean that some of the SEC people or Congress was investing with Bernie and that's why it didn't get busted too soon? Or, I mean, who had their money with them that didn't want to, like, see it go down?
That's a good question. Let's look at the cultural piece of that first. Harry, what about the culture of people both seeking these investment dollars and making these investments? Was it a culture that for some reason was especially susceptible?
Well, people are worried about their retirement, and they should, given the fiscal course our nation's on. It's a train wreck waiting to happen. People wanted to believe in those returns. They weren't finance professionals. These investors were basically people that were naive. They didn't know that 12%, a steady 1% a month, doesn't exist. So they wanted to believe, and they assumed that all the people around them that they knew that were invested with Madoff were much smarter than them, and surely they must have asked questions and done their due diligence. Therefore, it's safe to me. I don't need to ask questions. I can abandon all caution and put 100% of my eggs in one basket. And they did, and much to their regret.
Frank, what about the question that Christian raises about, who in positions of power might have themselves been profiting? Or even the issue of SEC, never mind oversight, SEC complicity.
Oh, there's the word that I used to use all the time. I mean, even when I was deposed by the Inspector General of the Securities Exchange Commission, his team, they said at the end of the deposition, Frank, what's the bottom line to you? And I said, well, in 2000 to 2003, I thought it was complacency on the part of the SEC. In 04 through 06, I thought it was incompetency. Anything after 06 had to be complicity. And they said to me, are you saying that we're going to be taking some guy out on a perp walk in handcuffs from the SEC? And I said in response, are you telling me that anybody could be that stupid for that long?
I haven't seen Harry Markopoulos. I haven't seen anybody perp walked out of the SEC.
I don't think that you will. I always thought it was incompetency. I felt if it was corruption, My name was known within the agency. They spread it around rather thickly there, and it would have gone right to Bernie Madoff, and he would have had me killed, and I'm still here. And I testified before the U.S. Senate in September. I said it was total systemic incompetence. There was no corruption. And if you read the SEC's Inspector General's report, it's 457 pages, and it's all about systemic incompetence, which is actually far more damaging. The SEC wishes they had a few bad apples that they could walk out on a perp walk and blame it on those few bad apples. And believe me, when they deposed me, they were looking at it as a criminal case. They were investigating the highest leadership ranks of the SEC, and they were looking at the team level and the branch level down at the bottom ranks. They were looking to make a criminal case, and there was none to be made, and I knew that there wasn't.
I capitulated after the SEC's IG's report.
And, but you're still shaking your head today.
Well, I mean, I just can't, you know, I basically said, here's the summary. I read the whole report, and it basically said to me, no, Frankie, you're wrong. They're just that stupid.
Harry, when you were talking with the SEC, spreading your documents and your analysis out on the table, give us a sense of how they took it on board or rejected it. What were those interactions like?
In May of 2000, I went in with Ed Mannion, who's a chartered financial analyst. He's a staff accountant, a senior staff accountant at the SEC, 25 years of industry experience. He'd worked at Fidelity as a portfolio manager. He'd worked at the Boston Company as a trader. He knew it was a fraud from day one, like I did. We met with a senior person, the director of enforcement for New England, Grant Ward, an attorney. He did not understand a word passed a low. He was untrained in finance, didn't understand any of the math. It was a total waste of a meeting, and he never submitted my case filing to the SEC's New York office like he should have the next day. He just trashed it.
Why? Was it? What was their attitude as they responded this way? Why would he be predisposed not to look seriously at this, even if he wasn't a mathematician?
Oh, it's the same reason why the press ignored this so often. It was so big. It was so much larger than the largest hedge funds in the world at that time, that it couldn't be true, because if it was, they would have discovered it already. And besides, Bernie Madoff was a respected citizen. He was such a big player in Wall Street. He seemingly didn't need to steal. Therefore, these people, I must have been delusional for coming in with this wild accusation.
Hartford, Connecticut. John, you're on the air, John.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm a SEC registered investment advisor, and I'm still a little puzzled as to why hedge funds are not officially regulated by the SEC. And would like your guest comments on that.
Still today, Frank, what do you think?
I think they should be. But I'll tell you something. Everybody in our industry, including your caller in, I would suspect, would back me up on this. Us in the industry that are registered would say, yes, we'll accept more registration, but not more of the same. I mean, what you get in this industry, and I have felt for 35 years that I have wasted my dues in paying to the self-regulatory organizations, what you get are six young people with laptop computers that show up at your office with checklists going through minutiae and files. Where is your customer complaint file? I've never had a customer complaint. I had 3-4 banks that I traded for. Well, you still have to have that manila folder that says customer complaints on it. That's a demerit. Instead of focusing in, because they couldn't focus in on anything that was really going wrong, I was clean, of course.
Because
been.
They didn't have the background
they
to
don't
see
have
it
the
if
background.
It was in front of them?
They were freshly out of college. You'd be lucky to get an MBA there at all. Now, the bosses that they worked for were all lawyers. And those people...
Not numbers men.
And Harry has brought up a good piece in front of Congress. I mean, he has stated, here's the way you solve this problem. Give me some gray hairs, dyed hairs, or no hairs. Give me some people in the business of running money that have been bloodied out there. They have capital markets knowledge. Put them on a team and have them at the SEC controlling the whistleblowing thing. Call them the financial untouchables, if you will, and have them run teams of investigators of trained people.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with the men who were on to Bernie Madoff before it all went down, the whistleblowing industry insiders who saw that Bernie Madoff was off the rails. Harry Markopoulos is with us. Frank Casey is here. They are co-authors of No One Would Listen, a true financial thriller, and it was, and a kind of tragedy, too, for people who lost life saving. Harry Markopoulos screamed his head off to the SEC, got nowhere with them. How could that happen? A lot of people thinking about it afterwards, a lot of very prominent people. Here's Nobel Prize winner Elie Wiesel at a panel discussion put together by Portfolio Magazine in February last year. He was himself a Madoff victim. And here he is saying that his awareness of what he did made his crime all the more despicable.
One little comment to you, Jim, about psychopath. It's too nice a word for him. Why? Because, you know, I studied psychology too. Psychopath means it's a sickness. Sociopath, psychopath, it's a pathology, it's sickness. The man knew what he was doing. And I would simply call him thief, scoundrel, criminal. Anyway, but whatever is to hurt him, I think should be invented.
Elie Wiesel on Bernie Madoff. Harry, we've got a lot of web comments here. Let me get the damage this man, says Jeff, has inflicted on people and institution is beyond belief. Prison is too good for this man. That's kind of in the Elie Wiesel line. Here's Steve says, and pray tell, what has changed? Where is the regulation and the competent people to enforce it? And here's one from Bob saying, why didn't Elliot Spitzer see this? What do you say to those, Harry?
First of all, there is no competence at the SEC. They don't have enough finance professionals. They're starting to hire them. They're starting to bring people on board. But they really need to offload their existing staff. They need to test the people that they have on the staff. Anybody who doesn't understand finance or accounting, they need to offload those people, let them find new homes somewhere else because they're not clearly welcome at the SEC. As far as going to Elliot Spitzer, I did on December 17, 2002. He was at the JFK Library speaking, I think, in the Profiles in Courage lecture series.
In Boston, yes.
I approached an aide there at the library, gave a set of documents that basically exposed Madoff. It was my SEC case submissions with no fingerprints on it.
You loaded them up with gloves on so they wouldn't track it back to you.
Well, I was afraid because Elliot Spitzer had a reputation for being a big hedge fund investor through his family's business. And in fact, they turned out to be investors. And I felt that if he knew Bernie Madoff, and certainly he was Jewish, he hung around in those circles in Manhattan, I felt that my life would be at risk. I had twin boys about to be born 3 months later.
But he was, Attorney General of the state of New York? You mean life at risk from him, or if it got out through him, or what do you mean?
Well, I had problems with the press believing me. People just didn't want to believe. They wanted to believe in Bernie. Here's the titan of Wall Street. Mm-hmm. Of course he's the king, and no one was going to believe the people that were doubting the king. So I was afraid to take a little bit too much risk there, and I wish I'd been braver. I wish I'd shaken Elliot Spitzer's hand, looked him in the eye, told him I'm president of the 4,000-member Boston Security Analyst Society. I'm a derivatives portfolio manager. I manage billions in derivatives. I understand the math, and I can prove to you mathematically in 25 minutes or less that Madoff's a fraud. I wish I had done that, but I didn't.
But you got the envelope into his hands. What happened?
I don't know. He says he never received it. I turned away as soon as the aide started walking toward him with the envelope. I didn't want my face to be recognized. So we don't know what happens. He's denying that he ever received the envelope.
You write in the book that at least at one point you had no doubts that Congressman Barney Frank, now chairman of the Financial Services Committee, was going to do whatever was necessary to change the culture at the SEC. Where's your confidence on that front at this moment? These are very live issues.
No one's been fired at the SEC, so I've lost hope. There's been no accountability at the banking regulators either. They all failed this nation. These people were stealing their paychecks. They were government employees, but they were working for the industries they were supposed to be overseeing. And I'm not seeing accountability, so I've lost faith.
Let's go to Benjamin in Stanton, Virginia. Benjamin, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Great show. Just a question and a comment. It seems to me that the culture that exists that allows this kind of thing to go on, the culture in which we denigrate greatly any notion at all whatsoever of even the most moderate form of real regulation
mm-hmm.
seems to exist. And I would like to know, on a more hopeful note, what way could you see that we could begin to change this? Because clearly it's not happening at the institutional level.
Harry, let's go first to you on that.
You can have all the rules in the world if you have incompetent people manning the regulatory agencies, if they're poorly paid, untrained, unskilled, and don't have any bonus system to look forward to, they're not incentivized to find the big cases, then all your rulemaking was for waste.
But what about, Benjamin says, we've got in this country have had a culture that denigrates the very idea of regulation. Do you see that as an issue or not?
Well, you certainly need more. You need to consolidate all the regulators into one single regulator. You can't have six or seven different regulatory bodies overseeing the capital markets, the nation's financial and banking system. You need to consolidate them so they're on one computer system so they can connect the dots. You need to send people in cross-functional teams. These big global conglomerates, they may have an insurance arm, an asset management arm, a broker-dealer arm, a banking arm. They're just so big and so global, you need to have a big regulator that's cohesive and has one data bank so that they can track the big guys and bring them to justice, because right now the big guys are continually escaping the dragnet.
Let's go to Bob in Mystic, Connecticut. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I am. Yeah, just a question for the author. I've been listening to the program. Excellent program, by the way. The author seems to have a bit of an edge, or not to be unkind, an attitude towards the individuals he's dealt with, whether it was Spitzer, the regulators, or the SEC. And my question is whether he feels a bit maybe put off that he was ignored while he was doing his investigation, or if he personally lost money in a Madoff scheme.
Ted, we'll ask Harry Markopoulos, but wouldn't you feel a bit unhappy if you'd warned about a $65 billion Ponzi scheme and everybody blew you off?
Well, this is true, but again, in listening to the program, some of his approach and being anonymous and being very careful and what have you, he may not have established his credibility with any of the individuals he was approaching.
That is interesting. Harry, what do you say?
The SEC knew who I was at every point in time. I certainly identified myself in May 2000, certainly in March 2001, in 2005. The branch chief and team leader knew my name, and it turned out everybody else at the SEC did too.
But did they know you and think you were a chronic, complainer, squeaky wheel for some reason? I don't know why they would, but... You hear Ted's wondering if you had, I don't know, some baggage or interest that made you look, angry or irrational to them.
Well, I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the infantry. Frank was commissioned a second lieutenant in the infantry. We took an oath, both of us, to support and defend this nation and the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Mm-hmm.
We saw Madoff as a domestic enemy. He was someone that was going to stain our capital market, stain this nation's reputation, and we stepped forward. We were just four men. But we had one shared belief. We believe in this nation's core values. That's why we stepped forward.
Sounds good
so,
enough.
So, yeah, I was damn angry that the government wasn't doing their job, because that's what we pay them to do.
Sounds good enough to me. Here's a web comment, Frank. This is from Ted. He says, there were many funds, Blackstone, for example, who would not have touched this with any length pole. They spend $100,000 to $1 million on due diligence. What's your comment?
He's right on. Every time you would meet somebody in this industry, the professional risk manager or whatever, mm-hmm. that understood the derivatives markets, understood the nature of split strike conversion or whatever, mm-hmm. you would ask them a question. I would. What do you know about Bernie? You never had to use the man's last name.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew who you were talking
mm-hmm.
about.
Mm-hmm.
And they would always turn about around and say, well, what do you know about Bernie? Everybody wanted to play the informational arbitrage game. They wanted more information than they were going to give out. And so you were trying to garner information, gather information on this monster and his tentacles. Okay, they all knew, these risk managers. It's very interesting to watch, to look at not who invested and lost their money, but who did not invest.
Mm-hmm.
None of the big banks invested in New York. Most of the banks in Boston didn't invest in, for instance, because we had contacts with those people, and they also would not invest unless they could understand where the money was coming from. And the ones that did invest were the people that invested through private wealth management banks or what were called hedge funds of funds, which were nothing more than glammed up feeder funds,
mm-hmm,
basically.
Mm-hmm.
So the professionals turned a blind eye and they walked away. Harry stood up and wanted to be counted.
But Harry, here's where the whole sort of story that nobody touched Madoff because he was Wall Street or investment world nobility and he was so great. But if the really smart guys in the smart funds weren't touching him, that story doesn't seem to hold up. The smart guys knew he wasn't, knew something was wrong.
And unfortunately, only the four of us went forward. There were two other whistleblowers that did blow the whistle on Madoff, and the SEC didn't listen to them either. We went back repeatedly for more. I was the point man. And the government could care less. They didn't want to do their jobs, and it shows. Look what happened last year with the financial collapse. We came very close to national bankruptcy. And so, thank God, there should have been more than four of us. More people should have come forward. The industry really needs to change its sense of ethics and sense of responsibility.
Paul in Newton, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Look, I represent the SEC employees and the board of the National Treasury Employees Union.
Okay.
I spent a career working for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. I know that the real cause of this problem was the political guys at the top. It was Chris Cox, who was an anti regulation congressman.
Mm-hmm.
He came in, he took over the SEC, and he handcuffed these guys. Now, Harry may have talked to two or three, I don't know how many, maybe half a dozen, but I can tell you there was a whole group of employees who wanted to do their jobs who were being handcuffed. That's my comment.
Paul, thank you for your call. Let us pick it up. Harry, the problem came from the top. George Bush put in Chris Cox. He was a congressman, didn't like regulation, handcuffed the SEC. What do you say?
The tone at the top at the SEC has been bad for a long, long time. You can't have securities lawyers as commissioners. They don't understand finance. I'd say some of it was tone at the top, but the employees, and I know he's a union member and a union leader, they're just not fit and competent for those jobs. I mean, they need to be replaced. The staff there is universally pretty bad. They have a couple stars. I met a couple of really superstars at the Boston Regional Office. Mike Garrity is a superstar. Joe Mix a superstar. Ed Mannion's a hero. I mean, there are good people at the SEC. There's just not enough of them.
They were structurally incompetent, not necessarily individually incompetent at all levels. I mean, there are good people at the SEC. However, they just couldn't do much about it. I agree.
I hear a little difference in message there. You're a little smoother and a little kinder, Frank. Harry tells it hard. Let's go to Jackie in Montreal, Canada. Jackie, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Your show's very interesting. I am a financial klutz.
Klutz, okay.
please forgive my ignorance here.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Where did all this money go? I mean, if he was handling all this money, billions apparently, how can it be lost? In whose pocket is it now? It's just beyond me as to how this money can be, you know, lost in such a manner. Can you please explain?
We'll try, Jackie. Thanks for calling. Harry, first to you.
Okay, Madoff was generating 16% gross returns. 12% he was delivering to the investors that were living off the income and taking distributions. He had other investors that were investing for capital gains who put money in, never took anything out. They got wiped out. The old investors that were investing for the 12% may have put in $1 million. If they were in long enough, they may have taken out $3 million or even $5 million. And so there you have the clawback there. The feeder funds took the next biggest piece. And the smallest piece went into the Madoff family's coffers. By far the smallest piece went into the Madoff family's coffers. So he spread it around. And so you have probably half the investors lost, and you probably have nearly half that maybe were net winners. And so that's where the money was, and Madoff was just taking the smallest piece for himself to make the merry-go-round spin.
Right. And we're at $65 billion and counting. Don't forget that Harry met with 14 wealth management banks out of 20 that said that they had Madoff, and these banks were in Europe. And only two have come forward and admitted it. And the other 12 were turned over to the appropriate regulatory authorities, and nothing has happened. We were expecting a ton of phone calls and questions from mm-hmm. these regulatory authorities over there. And I don't think they want to know. They're not going to query us because they really don't want to see it.
I mean, a lot of the money, to Jackie's question, though, actually went to
Absolutely. As I was saying, every 4.25 years at a 16% gross outflow, you're going to need to double your money just to stay
standstill. So a
bunch
of people made a lot of money. We hear about all the money that was lost, but a bunch of people made.
That's correct. And the $65 billion in counting, don't forget that's not $65 billion actually invested. It may have been anywhere around $25 or $30 billion, mm-hmm. and the rest is compounding mm-hmm. or what they thought they were receiving.
That number's got some punkiness in it.
Well, yeah, because a lot of people who left their money in, as Harry says, mm-hmm. Thought they were making 12%, and there was nothing there because there was not even any trading going on.
Air.
So a lot of it is air to start with. Mm-hmm. Although it was interesting, I saw on a crawl this morning, a news crawl on TV on a financial channel, that some judge had ruled that people can sue for what they thought they had earned, not just what they lost when they put in.
Well, good luck to them. Good luck to them there. Jeff in Weston, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm not advocating it, but you know, everybody that I know, and I know a few people pretty high in the financial world here, mm-hmm. and if they lost that kind of money, they'd be pretty upset. And I'm just wondering why Bernie is still alive. I mean, if I lost, somebody took me for $10,000, I'd be pretty mad. But these people lost millions, and he seems to be walking around quite freely.
Well, not exactly freely, but it's not a capital offense. But, what about it, Harry? I mean, there is a lot of loss and anger and rage out there about Madoff.
Well, I like where he is now. He's in a medium security prison. I really thought he should have been in supermax because I do worry that someone would get to him in medium security. I'd like to see him in maximum security, not have any freedom, no human contact. I think that would be a crueler and more unusual form of punishment, which I think he merited. But I don't get to choose that. That's the Bureau of Prisons' choice.
Are we going to see another Bernie Madoff? Will this happen again, Harry? Have we learned enough? Have we changed enough?
I think in the Ponzi arena, you will not see anything this big. You'll still see Ponzi schemes, but the SEC now prioritizes them. They used to be a low priority. Now they're a high priority. This case taught them what to look for. They now know how to solve it because my team solved it, so they can use us as a benchmark. How we did the case, we put it in the book. It's not that hard to solve these. They figured it out now, and I think they'd be very on the spot on stopping these things as they start. So you're going to see other forms of fraud, more involving derivatives and structured products, because the SEC doesn't understand those products either.
You once thought you might be killed for looking into this. You once thought you might have to or want to kill Bernie Madoff. If you could speak to him today, what would you say, Harry?
I wouldn't want to meet him. I think he's a pathological liar. He doesn't owe me any explanation. He needs to answer to his victims. I certainly don't qualify. He has a higher duty to them. He knows me no duty.
Frank, do you think it'll happen again? Is it human nature?
It's happening now.
Happening now?
Absolutely. I've received, about a year ago, I received an email from a friend of mine who's a financial risk manager. He said, Frank, you understand foreign currency trading. Take a look at this and tell me what you think. I looked at page 2 of the PowerPoint. Page 1 was the name of the firm.
Mm-hmm.
I called the guy up and said it's an absolute fraud. I explained why. Page 3 sealed it for me because they wrapped it in all kinds of religious gobbledygook.
Yep.
And I said, how much is this idiot running? He says, $700 million. We turned it in to the regulatory authorities. Haven't heard word one yet.
Buyer beware and regulators, come on. Frank Casey and Harry Markopoulos, co-authors of No One Would Listen. Thanks to you both for being with us today.
Our pleasure, believe me.
Thank you, Harry.
Thank you.
Thank you, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.